fastest growing part of the internet is the World Wide Web, an area that combines text, graphics, and pictures.
Between the cookie and the image, you had a tracking system without knowing it. And we did this naively.
Essentially, every click, every online interaction is recorded by dozens, hundreds, perhaps even thousands of so-called third parties online.
Of mobile phone scam called SIM swapping.
This was one of the largest data breaches in history.
We are playing fast and loose with our data.
It's important to understand the sheer scale here.
Surveillance capitalism is driven to shape and influence our behavior.
It's just kind of a shrug, like, well, what can you really do?
And welcome back to the new year and Signal Jam. I'm your co-host, Jay.
And I'm your co-host, Michael.
And we're almost wrapping up our 101 series, so today we'll discuss browsers, search engines, the why, and our own setups. Michael, how about you start us off with how we're being tracked on the internet and how this impacts browsers?
Yeah, thanks, Jay, and I hope you had a great new year, and everybody that's listening, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the new year. Let's dive into it. Before we get into this, I do want to clarify our language going forward. For the purposes of this episode, when we talk about being tracked on the web, we're referring to how that is performed within the context of a browser, on your computer or mobile device. We're not talking about tracking done via apps. The reason we're making this distinction is because the technologies, the processes, the tools we'll talk about apply to browser-based web interactions, while apps are better understood somewhat separately, and that topic could easily constitute its own episode. Virtually everything we do online can be tracked. And what I mean by that is that our interactions with websites, even the most mundane, are observed and collected, analyzed, synthesized, compiled, shared, and ultimately sold. But that's such a large and broad statement, it's kind of like trying to wrap your mind around the vastness of the universe. So let's start by trying to break this down into more manageable chunks. How are we being tracked, and what is being tracked? Well, first, we need to understand a little bit about browsers. Web browsers are actually quite sophisticated software that translate a lot of code into a visually attractive and easy-to-navigate interface. Anything you see on a site is actually just a bunch of code written by the site developer, and your browser interprets that code into something that looks presentable, a website. During that interpretation process, websites can interact with your computer in a variety of ways. One such way that we've all heard about and seen numerous banners for is cookies. Cookies are just a small text file that a website can store in your browser, which resides ultimately on your computer. But cookies in themselves are not inherently bad, and some serve important functional purposes, like remembering that you're logged into your account or whether you want the site to display in a light or dark mode, for instance. But cookies can also be used to track you on a particular website or as you navigate across the web. There's also script-based tracking. JavaScript code embedded on a website can cause certain information about your browser and device to be exposed. And some, but certainly not all, of that boring technical information includes things like your IP address, your operating system and what version of that operating system, your browser and what version of that browser, your time zone, your screen resolution, the fonts you have installed on your computer, the size of your browser window, the battery level of your device, links that brought you to the website, the links that you click on the website, the links that take you away from the website. And it gets creepier. Far beyond that quote-unquote boring technical stuff, more advanced scripts can collect more advanced information. Things like which pages you visit for how long, how far you scroll on a page, your cursor movements and where your mouse lingers, your keystrokes and the speed and pattern of those keystrokes, embedded videos that you watch or files that you download, whether you abandon that shopping cart after adding some items to it. Scripts can also make a good guess as to the kinds of extensions your browser is using too. Password managers, ad blockers, coupon hunters. And scripts can also get information about your browser canvas. And to get a better understanding of that canvas, let's go play another part of that clip from the intro.
The way it works is that this company, this third party that's hidden on the site, sends a sequence of commands to your browser that causes it to draw an image, a hidden image that you would not know is being drawn on your screen. But the way that your browser is going to interpret those commands is going to be different based on the version number, based on various other things, even based on what is the set of fonts you have installed on your computer.
When a website says, hey, try to draw this line, draw this curve, draw this shape, render this image, your web browser goes, ooh, graphics editing, that's best suited for a graphics card, and it hands that over to your graphics card. So it draws this picture, and it draws it with so much attention to detail that if you ask any other graphics card running any other version of software, running on any other computer to do the same thing, it'll look just a little bit different. So if you ask the same web browser to draw the same picture again, you'll be able to remember who it was who drew the picture with exactly those pixels in exactly those places.
The only analogy I can think to liken this process to is a forensic artist. A forensic artist produces an image of a criminal suspect based on a description from an eyewitness. So in this analogy, the eyewitness is the website describing an image to the forensic artist, your browser, to be drawn. But it kind of goes a bit further in that you might also imagine that the eyewitness is an expert art critic and can usually peg the artist just by observing that style of art. It's kind of how this works in a digital setting. WebGL is a similar process, except it renders a 3D image, and this technology can also be used in tracking. There's also web beacons, sometimes referred to as tracking pixels or spy pixels or a pixel tag. Web beacons are a very crafty way to track you, and the way they work is by embedding code on a website you visit, which requests an image from the server of a data tracker. And this image is usually transparent in just one pixel in size, which makes them pretty much undetectable to the viewer. And when the site you're visiting makes a request to load that tiny invisible pixel, it sends information about you and your device to that tracking server in the process. Meta famously makes use of this technology with their Metapixel and allows for site owners to install the code for a Metapixel in their own website, tying together information about viewers of the site and its corresponding social media channels. Webbeacons can also work in conjunction with cookies by attaching information from those cookies with the other information that's sent when it requests the tracking pixel. Now, what I just outlined is not an exhaustive list, and there are other methods out there you can find through a simple web search. As technology evolves quickly, so do new methods of tracking. But with these things in mind, there's one other technology I want to briefly talk about, and that's fingerprinting. Fingerprinting is essentially a way to identify a person through the characteristics of their device, browser, and the associated data being collected. It's sort of an aggregate of everything we just walked through. And until recently, research has showed fingerprinting is possible, and proof of concepts have demonstrated this. But what's been more unclear is whether the technology was actually being used for privacy-invasive means in advertising. But in April last year, a collaborative research article between multiple universities and an American technology company showed compelling evidence that that's exactly what's happening. And specifically, they found that, quote, browser fingerprinting significantly impacts ad tracking with noticeable differences in bid values and reduction in HTTP records when fingerprints change, end of quote. So the reason we should be aware of fingerprinting is that it's a little bit more difficult to mitigate. And shortly, when we talk about some solutions to all these problems, we'll bring this up again. But for now, just keep it in mind that it's an evolving technology that is likely being used to invade our privacy. Okay, by now you should agree that websites are a prime medium to be tracked on, and the ways to do so are many. But the choice of browser we use is important too. By far, Google Chrome is the most popular web browser, and it absolutely dominates the market. In October 2025, just a few months ago, StatCounter recorded Chrome at an all-time high of over 73%. This preeminence gives Google quite a bit of power. There are numerous stories detailing how Google has misled and deceived users about their privacy on Chrome. And unfortunately, because Chrome is closed source, meaning the code for the browser is proprietary and not made public, we'll never know the full extent of Google's privacy incursions. But we know how they make their money, and even by trying to configure the browser's settings to be more private, it's really not safe to place our trust in it. So, for this reason and many others, we should shift to better browsers, ones that are open source, that have better privacy-preserving features, and show general respect to the user. And thankfully, making the switch is very easy, and there are several good options out there, and we'll talk shortly about these. Jay, I want to hand this back over to you, since you've prepared some information for us about some general steps we can take to configure our browsers for better privacy. What do you have for us?
Thank you, Michael. Now we've explored the various means by which our browsing is tracked, let's look at these solutions or attempts to mitigate. As this space is constantly in a state of flux, browsers improve their ability to stop tracking. Companies and platforms continue to develop methods around these. We'll tackle each of these data points generally, then shift to suggested browser options and our own personal setups. Before we get into the weeds, let's take a moment to acknowledge the majority of users likely don't shift from their default browser. These come pre-installed with the operating system, so it's easy for many to just use Google Chrome, Microsoft Edge, or Safari, and think nothing as to whether they should be. There's often the running gag that Microsoft Edge only serves to the purpose of searching for and downloading another browser, and I'd consider you to take this to heart. For me, one of the biggest tells that maybe we should consider alternatives is no clearer than it is with Microsoft Edge on Windows. You can't uninstall it, it is the default, and they will prompt you often to use it, particularly if you go to use something else. Whilst we often talk about open source options being better for privacy, in this instance, the reasons are just as much to do with freedom of choice. We know companies like Microsoft, Google, Apple collect and harvest data. This is usually in the name of quote-unquote user experience. It should be considered a given that their proprietary browsers continue this trend of data collection. So at the very least, we should seek to minimize this the best we can. Often the best way to do this is to avoid these options entirely, or at the very least, reviewing the settings that are enabled before deciding if we want them to be. First, cookies. We can actually adjust our cookie preferences in our browser settings to block third-party cookies, or at least prompt consent before setting any at all. This is arguably the bare minimum you should be doing. Now, you can obviously choose to install browser extensions, which automatically delete cookies after a certain time, when you close a tab, or manage those consent preferences. But I'd argue the majority of the time, particularly with some of the browsers we'll discuss, these aren't necessary, and could ironically create a new identifier. Browsers typically provide a way to manually manage cookies, or set your browser to automatically delete them upon exit. My preferred method is private browsing, that is using private or incognito modes, which typically don't store cookies once the browser is closed. Lastly, it's worth mentioning that previously you could enable what was referred to then as Do Not Track feature, now referred to as Global Privacy Control, or GPC. GPC operates as a Do Not Sell mechanism in some US states such as California, Colorado, and Connecticut. However, this may also be used to indicate an opt-out of targeted advertising or a general request to limit the sale or sharing of personal data in those such jurisdictions. For scripts, the solution is nuanced. Many sites need JavaScript to function, and even some of the most privacy-respecting services that we use or recommend include it. You can even look at our site, signaljam.me, and see JavaScript present. All this to say that, like many tools and services running on sites, it isn't inherently malicious. Rather, it can serve a functional purpose. It can, however, at least regain some control over when and where we use JavaScript, with most browsers allowing for the disabling of scripts within their settings. For more granular control over this, extensions like NoScript and uBlock Origin can be installed. uBlock Origin specifically has remained a popular choice for a lot of people in the privacy space, and as extensions like HTTPS everywhere find themselves no longer needed, with browser settings allowing for similar functionality from the start, uBlock has remained a staple. It's community-maintained filter lists, by default blocking a large number of ads, trackers, and malware. It also gives the users capabilities to define what they do and don't want displayed or filtered. I'd argue these two extensions and most browser setting tweaks actually mitigate a lot of the tracking from cookies, web beacons, and scripts. And in our previous episode, we discussed VPNs, which we use to obscure our true IP address, and DNS, in many cases, gives us control over our domain connections, tracker, and ad blocking. So we see that these tools and services together allow for a more controlled, cleaner, and more private web browsing experience. Despite this, some maintenance and upkeep should still be implemented, so ensure your browsers, your extensions, and your operating systems are up to date. Review browser settings after new updates to ensure nothing has changed or been switched back on, which does occasionally happen. Manually clear history and site data, heck, clean install if you're feeling particularly paranoid. Other things to consider is the compartmentalization of browsers for different use cases. There's also container extensions and profiles within browsers that can be used to better isolate your browsing. Some browser extensions are a must, others are just nice to have. As mentioned, uBlock Origin and NoScript, but also Firefox containers, Mulvad Browsers extension for use with Mulvad VPN, Bitwarden, Simple Login, Proton VPN, the list goes on. It's typically a rule of thumb that the more extensions you add, the more risks, or that is, attack services, as well as a more unique browser fingerprint. Something, as we mentioned, we aim to avoid. Specifically, Mulvad and Tor Browser both focus heavily on this, and actively discourage the additional installation of extensions outside their defaults. But in some cases, if the addition of an extension allows for greater adherence to the adoption of secure and private practices, say using a password manager or a master email address, the drawbacks could be considered worth your while. So hopefully that's giving you some actionable steps to take, even if it's just smaller steps, like simply opening and viewing your browser settings, seeing what it is you can do and what you can control. So now, moving on to default browser alternatives. What we look at when we seek to shift from Google Chrome, Microsoft Edge, or Safari. Arguably, anything is better than these defaults. Even while some options, like Safari, aren't awful, we can do better. Overall, your browser choice will be personal. You may or may not agree with our choices, and that's fine. These are just general recommendations, and are applicable in majority of alternatives that you find. And now, how about we hear about your setup, Michael?
Sure, yeah. Thanks for walking us through that, Jay. That sounds good, and I'm glad for all the details. My setup has kind of evolved and changed over the years. When I first got started in the privacy game, I think it tended to be stock Firefox as the main recommendation and suggestion, so I started with that. And back then, Firefox hadn't necessarily implemented all the same privacy-preserving measures that it has now, so I was a little bit more reliant on third-party extensions to help fill in some of those gaps. So not only was I using uBlock Origin, I was also tapping into things like Decentralize, as you mentioned, container tabs, there was cookie auto delete, and some of those core functions have now since been rolled into main Firefox. And these days, I've kind of shifted a bit, and I'm glad you mentioned earlier about using different browsers for different use cases. typically, I find myself using Mulvad browser the most often, which works nicely, especially since I use Mulvad VPN. I also use LibreWolf, which is another Firefox fork. And then I also have Brave on my system, which I use for some isolated, not as common use case scenarios. And then I also have Tor. So I guess in total, four browsers, right? It's Mulvad, LibreWolf, Brave, and Tor. Mulvad tends to be my daily driver since it has that awesome Mulvad extension. And we talked about this in the last episode too, but I find that it's very handy for general browsing. Technically speaking, it's a fork of Tor, which in itself is a fork of Firefox. But what I like about Mulvad browser's design philosophy is that they try to overcome some of the hurdles that are presented with things like fingerprinting by making you blend into a larger crowd. So prepper communities sometimes talk about this concept of being a gray man, which is dressing in a sort of bland aesthetic in a way that's not particularly memorable. It means you don't have necessarily standout qualities. There's, you know, if somebody was asked to describe you, they might think of you just, you know, casual hoodie, blue jeans, not very special, makes you difficult to pick out of a crowd. And I think that's kind of what Tor, well, certainly that's what Tor is doing and what Mulvad browser is trying to do by extension of that. LibreWolf I use kind of intermittently. Sometimes I tend to use LibreWolf for my more trustworthy sites like our site, the back end for our site, Proton Mail, Tuda, that kind of thing. Brave, I tend to use for sites that experience a lot of breakage. One thing that's pretty common, and I'm sure you've run into this too, is that a lot of websites, because as we mentioned earlier, Google Chrome has such a stranglehold, such a dominance on the market share, a lot of sites are optimized for Chrome usage. So if there's breakage I'm experiencing, I'll shift to Brave. And then lastly, I use Tor just as kind of a stopgap. I'm sort of toying around the idea of using that a little bit more for general browsing. And Tor does a really, really good job making you blend into that crowd like we talked about. And of course, you can use it also to access the dark web and visit onion sites and that kind of thing. I don't really use it for that purpose. There are a few categories of sites that I will absolutely always use Tor for. So for instance, I don't touch Google or Facebook or Meta sites, some of those big, big, big tech companies with a 10-foot pole. On the rare occasion that I have to visit a Google link, so sometimes when we're putting together show notes, I have to find something that's on, you know, Google's or Meta's website and link to those in our show notes. I will use Tor for that. But other than that, as far as the daily drivers go, especially with Mulvad and LibreWolf, I tend to leave those relatively untouched. I think the only thing I've really gone and done to customize those is add additional filter lists inside of uBlock Origin. I think I've bumped up the safety levels in Mulvad to stricter, I think, is the medium level. So that's kind of my setup. I try to keep it as out of the box as possible. I do have Firefox still on my computer, which I use very, very sparingly. And that I've taken a lot more time to kind of customize and make sure that it's doing all the things that Mulvad and LibreWolf tend to do by default. But anyways, what about you? What do you like to do for your setup?
Much like you, I maintain a variety of browsers for separate use cases. Ideally, I want my browsers to be available cross-platform. You know, I want to be able to change certain default things like the default search engines. I want to be able to have, you know, custom DNS, native ad blocking, extension capabilities. Currently, like much like you, I do use Brave as well. I find for those sites that want or need that Chromium-based browser functionality. Whilst I avoid Google Chrome, obviously, and it's still based on Chromium, it's just that Brave is the better open source alternative. I can customize it and power it down to, you know, clean of any unused or unwanted features. Some of the most robust ad blocking and fingerprinting protection I've experienced online, I guess, in terms of, you know, browsers I've used. I still think Chromium-based browsers, some of the most secure, you know, their regular updates. They definitely, at least in my personal experience, I've always found them to be slightly faster, you know, more efficient rendering and processing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once my preferences have been set up, it's kind of that drop-in Google replacement for me. If I need a Chrome-based browser, I use Brave. Now, despite, you know, how reliable I find Brave to be, it's actually not my preferred browser. My default, much like you, is Mulvad browser. Number of reasons I prefer it, but generally speaking, it's I don't have to adjust much in the settings. Like you say, out of the box, it kind of just works. I don't feel like I need to tinker around too much. And by default, it includes things like uBlock Origin and NoScript pre-installed.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, private browsing modes enabled by default, so those cookies will be deleted after I exit. Mulvad DNS is provided as one of the default DNS options.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, as you mentioned, with Mulvad VPN, if you're using that with Mulvad browser, you get that proxy access, which I've only really started to lean on a little more recently, and I feel like I really was missing out when I didn't realize I could use this feature as much as I can.
Yeah, it's really a game changer. It does help a lot.
For sure. I don't realize until I'm actually using it or feeling like, oh no, Malvad VPN's been blocked again. How I just toggle on the proxy, see how that goes. And don't get me wrong, I'll still occasionally get a block with the proxy, but nowhere near as often as I was with just the VPN. It's like Tor Browser, but made more for the ClearNet, for sure. For when, you know, you want that general anonymous browsing, you don't have that higher threat model, or you don't have a particular tracker you really want to avoid, kind of thing. And I think that that's where Malvad kind of fits kind of in between, like a lot of some of the options. Like I would use Firefox, Malvad, and then Tor in that order, kind of thing.
Sure.
Like progressively my threat model would increase and I would shift to a different browser. I do keep Firefox on my laptop as well. Much like you, I've hardened it to a similar extent to Malvad. It's just I use Firefox differently to how I use Malvad. Malvad for me is definitely the general browsing kind of thing where I want to be generally anonymous and blend in. For my personal accounts and logins, definitely still stick with Firefox. I like a dedicated browser for my personal accounts just so I don't mix things up or
Interesting.
But I definitely have tried LibreWolf. I like it. And for me, I can get generally the same customization to LibreWolf with Firefox. It's just by default, LibreWolf is available with a lot of those presets. So I definitely see the appeal for that too.
Yeah. Real quick, let me ask you about your thoughts on Tor, because I feel like inevitably some of the questions we might end up getting about this, and I've heard this kind of discussed throughout the privacy community in the past, is since Malvad browser is technically a fork of Tor, why should one use Tor versus Malvad browser or vice versa? Do you have a take on that?
I think for me, the situation is nuanced. For me, Tor is the highest of threat models. It's the one where I feel like I cannot mess this up, kind of thing. I cannot risk the tracking. And to that same extent, I guess reputable VPN, Malvad browser, you could probably get a similar protection, but I wouldn't say it's as censorship resistant as Tor would be. And as you mentioned, onion sites, if you need onion sites.
Yeah.
I think the only difference that is significant enough for me is Tor browser has that native Tor feature, I guess. It's natively able to access Tor and it's made with the understanding it will be used on the Tor network. Malvad browser wasn't made with that intention. It was made with the intention to be used with a VPN.
Yeah. I think it's also worth pointing out too that, as you mentioned, there's some nuanced cases for why you would use Tor, right? Specifically, people with very high threat models would make sense that you would use that. The other thing is that I think Tor and Malvad browser take slightly different approaches. It's like different sides of the coin. Tor is best used when you need high anonymity, right? Anonymity can be described as you know the actions being done, but not by whom. Whereas privacy is you know the person, but not their actions, right? So with Malvad browser, being a fork of Tor, it ports over a lot of those features that are rooted in that anonymity, but it transforms it into privacy. So the fact that it comes baked in with uBlock, that's a big departure from what Tor presents, right? And so Tor, when you're browsing the web, you are bombarded with all those trackers and whatnot. The idea, though, is that so many people using Tor, for lack of a better phrase, it's almost like you're kind of poisoning the data well, because everybody kind of looks the same. You're coming from the Tor network. So there's, you know, these trackers have a lot more people to follow, and it's harder to profile and fingerprint you off those kinds of properties. Whereas with Malvad browser, if you do want some more privacy and you want to be able to kill off some of those tracking and ad blocking kind of abilities, then that's a use case where you might use Malvad browser.
Yeah, I think it kind of got right there in the sense of, you know, Tor is for anonymity. Malvad browser is more for the privacy aspect. So it really does depend. But yeah, as you say, I think it does boil down to, you know, those use cases and those, you know, where on that sliding scale do you want more of? Do you want more anonymity or do you want more privacy? Or do you want to slide somewhere in the middle there?
Right. Before we move into the last thing, I think something else that's probably worth just a brief discussion about is what do we use on mobile? I'll go first because I have a hot take on this.
Go for it.
So I'm ready for the criticism. Send it on. I use Graphene OS. That's my daily driver. I don't really use Vanadium, which I know is kind of heresy. And there's a lot of people who in the graphene and privacy community insist that Vanadium is the best way to use the web while you're on your Android. And I don't deny that. I use Brave And it's kind of silly. I acknowledge that it's probably not quite as secure as Vanadium, not quite as hardened as it is. What I really like about Brave Browser on Android is that it gives you the ability to know in real time that it is indeed blocking trackers. Let me hand that to you real quick. What's your take on this? What do you use on your mobile?
I do use Vanadium, not because I inherently feel strongly about it. Either way, I think Brave is just as equally a good option. If I'm honest, I just don't have to maintain another app.
Sure.
I don't have to keep updating Brave. I notice Brave gets a lot of updates. I just kind of like that, obviously, you know, with the operating system, with Graphene, Vanadium is updated automatically. If I had to choose another Android browser, I'd probably maybe select Firefox Focus, but I'd probably still, much like you, lean probably more on Brave, just because in this case it is because it's a Chromium-based browser. Mm-hmm. I think for me, because I don't use the browser all that heavily on my mobile device, I think. I don't use it enough to warrant an excessive amount of customization that I think is needed. I'll still use a custom DNS, I'll still change my search engine, but I can do that within Vanadium. And I don't know if you've noticed, but Brave browser on Android, you can't use a custom search engine. I imagine that will eventually change. I know it's been in, I think, the GitHub page for a while, or some requests on their forums about the ability to add a custom search engine on Brave on Android.
Right. I feel like this makes a good segue into search engines, which probably, you know, the most common website or one of the most common websites that people tend to jump to once they open up their browser. You pop open Brave or Chrome or whatever browser you're using, and then you go to Google search, right? So once you are using a more private browser, we've already kind of established that, like, if you're taking these steps, you should probably just shift away from Google and from Bing and some of those others altogether into something that's more privacy oriented. So I'll let you go first. What do you use? What do you like to, what's your go-tos?
Currently I'm using DuckDuckGo's No AI search engine, in which I get those same, you know, DuckDuckGo results, but I get them without the AI baked in there, without all the kind of the excess stuff that I didn't really want. I like to use a search engine like a search engine. I'm not wanting instant answers. I want to be able to use my own decision making, I guess, to choose pages that I think are more maybe reputable or maybe more relevant to what I'm looking for. And I like to make the decision myself. I don't want something summarized in an instant for me necessarily. I do typically avoid AI in general. We discuss AI at some point in a later episode, maybe, but I typically avoid it at least in the use of search engines. In saying that, I do know my partner, I know some relatives who would prefer, you know, Google results, and Star Page is a good option for them. And that, you know, there are alternatives, you know, obviously it's Brave Search. We mentioned Brave Browser. Brave has its own search engine, which I guess it's more of a web crawler, its own kind of dedicated thing. There are a lot of options, frankly, with search engines these days, and they're getting more. There's obviously, you know, Kagi, which has come out recently. It's a premium service where you pay for your search queries, I guess, in a sense of you're paying to avoid the ads.
I'll tell you the one search engine I do have kind of on my radar that I would actually love to get these guys on the show and talk to them at some point is Mojik. I think they're a really interesting business model, and they are like, they have some information on their website about the history of their company and how it got started, and it is kind of an interesting story. But it's basically a bespoke web crawling indexer, so it's unique and different. And I've tried it. I tested it a little while ago, just to give it a shot, and it's not quite as robust as I want it to be. But they do seem to have a pretty keen interest in making a serious effort to become a competitor in that space. Most of the search engine alternatives out there, including DuckDuckGo and Startpage, are just proxying requests, right? There's not really like Google is so successful because it has its own indexing technology that's been around now for, we're coming up on close to 30 years.
I'd say, like, in general, I think any competition in this area, much like with browsers, I mean, maybe browsers less so. I feel like we've got an abundance at this point. But I'd say search engines is definitely one of those areas where we don't really want to have to proxy, you know, major corporate results, because we don't really want to have to just keep proxying Google and Bing results.
Feeding the beast.
Yeah, like we're still giving them money in some regards there.
Yeah.
And if, you know, Google and Bing don't become so, you know, I guess heavyweights in that area, then we might see those, you know, those default search engines maybe not be Google, maybe not be Bing.
Right.
It'd be nice to see something other than those two as defaults. People just kind of want those choices. So it's they want those wins without so many losses, which I guess could bring us to this week's privacy wins and losses, if you're up for that.
Yeah, let's do it. You go first.
Okay, so recently I've been trying out different masked payment methods. I don't know if people within this space know particularly well. I'd argue they know a lot. That privacy.com is a great option within the US.
For Americans. If you're not American, sorry.
Yeah, the rest of the world has to deal with, frankly, lesser options, but we do still have options. And I think it's BMS, not to mention, you know, at least one or two that I've tested recently and had success with would be Revolut and Wise. They're not tailored to privacy enthusiasts. They're not tailored necessarily for that privacy benefit like privacy.com is. They are tailored to travelers and, you know, people who are exchanging money internationally. That's not to say it has plenty of benefit for privacy enthusiasts and those who want more secure payment methods without handing over, you know, card details and expecting those to, you know, find those later in breaches. Or, you know, if you don't trust a particular website you want to purchase something from, that's definitely something I would use one of these masked payment methods for. So for me, Revolut I've had plenty of success with that. You get to generate a number of multi-use digital cards. So if you have a particular service you want to use a card with, you can dedicate that card solely to that service. You can set, you know, card controls. You know, you want it to only be used for ATM withdrawals, like your normal physical card, or you want to attach it to a payment wallet, like a digital wallet, like Garmin Pay, Apple Pay, Google Pay, those kind of things. You can definitely do that with those digital cards. You can do that with Wise too. For me, the distinctive benefit from each service is Revolut has more cards. Wise gives me more flexibility. Hmm. Now, in terms of flexibility, I mean, Revolut, you are forced to use the app. They have no two-factor authentication methods outside of, you know, fingerprint, face ID, unlock kind of thing. You get pass keys. You don't get, I was experiencing a lot of the SMS two-factor authentication. I prefer, you know, simple two-factor authentication via my Authenticator app. Yeah, SMS is probably, it's better than nothing, but I prefer two-factor authentication app, pass keys. In my case, I found Wise, I could implement two-factor authentication via SMS, by app, and by pass key.
Nice.
And that was, something about that felt particularly secure compared to obviously Revolut. There was also the freedom. I could use Wise within a web browser. It didn't care what web browser I used. Vanadium worked, Brave worked, Firefox worked. They didn't care.
Nice.
They didn't care about my VPN usage. And obviously with these services, much like privacy.com, you're not going to get out of KYC. The way in which you are KYC'd will differ though somewhat. Revolut, it is the selfie. It is the scanning of the photo taking of your ID. Do not love that. Hate that immensely. That is typically automated. There is no toggling out of that one. Wise actually does allow you to have your ID manually verified and not stored for the year that is when it's automatically verified, which is an interesting but delightful thing to see that that is actually an option. Like your selfie is compared with your ID manually.
That's a great win, yeah.
So yeah, for me, that's a win. I'm having some wins and I'm liking that. How about you? How about your wins and losses there?
Yeah, well, I definitely have a loss, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I do have a couple wins I'll share. I actually should have brought this up last episode, and I think I just kind of got sidetracked. But a few months ago, I was traveling, and I stayed at a Vrbo. This was the second time I tried Vrbo based on Ray Heffer's advice in his podcast, The Lockdown. He mentioned that he's had better success with Vrbo and staying in Vrbo properties anonymously. So when my partner and I were traveling, we were able to do that and it worked great. I was able to sign up with the alias information using a privacy.com card. The host never asked questions, never asked to see a copy of our IDs or anything like that. So Vrbo is definitely in my arsenal of tools now to use when I travel. And we're going to be traveling again probably within a few months here, and I'll likely try that again there too. So yeah, I liked that. The other travel route I went was an anonymous hotel stay, which was actually full transparency. This is the first time I've actually successfully pulled this off. So we arrived at the hotel late, pretty late in the evening. I think it was like 11:30 at night. And I walked in the hotel lobby and I found the guy at the front desk. I just really kind of hammed it up. I played it up. I said, "Hey man, I'm really hoping you can help me out here. My partner and I have been on a 2-week long road trip and we left one of our bags with our wallets in a few states away when we left this morning. I've just tried 4 other hotels and all of them turned me away because we don't have our IDs. Is there any way you can help us out?" And I just kind of really, you know, pleaded and played up to his humanity. And I offered to pay cash and pay an extra deposit for the trouble. And he he obliged, but made it clear he was doing me a pretty big favor and kind of used hushed tones and mentioned that this was not, you know, this was breaking protocol and they would not like this. So he, you know, he was happy to do it, but you know, it was kind of a one-time thing or whatever. And I was many, many states away from where I live. So I wasn't worried about this becoming an issue again down the road, but, said he absolutely needed a credit card to put on file. And that was like the one thing he needed. And so I just leaned on my lost wallet story and played up like I was trying to find a solution. I said, oh, can you take my virtual credit card? I've got that info saved on my phone. And he agreed. So I had privacy.com fired up and ready to go. And I offered to show him. So I kind of turned my phone. I was like, do you need to see the virtual card? And he said, yeah, I'll take a look at it. And all in all, though, we ended up getting a very comfortable room. It was completely anonymous, worked out really well. So I'll try that again down the road. I haven't quite done the Bazaal route yet where I have like a, you know, custom made ID, but hopefully I can try that again down the road too, because social engineering isn't always guaranteed to work. So
I was going to say that's incredible, because like I don't think I'd ever quite have the goal to try that here, at least in terms of like the social engineering to like, you know, to stay at a place like it. You're right. It probably, there might be, you know, some people who might be willing to, you know what, you're going through a rough patch kind of thing. We'll let that slide as long as, you know, as you've got the payment kind of thing. I'm yet to really try it. I'm probably a little more uncomfortable trying the social engineering than maybe you are. I don't know. I'd like to try it at some point, but that's overall, I'm ecstatic to hear someone winning in that area.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun, man. I wasn't totally sure it was going to work, but like I said, I kind of hammed it up and he bought it. So, social engineering is definitely a viable method, you know, from time to time. Okay. I'll be transparent about my loss. This was not a huge privacy loss, but it definitely bothered me. So for now I'm on macOS and I have it locked down with Little Snitch, to the best of my ability. I follow Michael Bazell's guidance to use different profiles on Little Snitch, so that you can lock everything down except for when you need to update the Mac and then you change the profile. It opens up that that DNS so that you can reach out to Apple servers, get, you know, check to see if there's an update, download it, et cetera. So I went through that process. I changed my profile, got the update from Apple. When it finished downloading and prompted me to reinstall, I decided to do something different that I don't normally do. And to be honest, I don't know why. I think it just kind of occurred to me. I was like, oh, I've never tried this before. I'll just do it. Didn't think much about it, but I changed the profile back to Apple disabled, rebooted the computer. It was trying to finish optimizing that update once it had installed, and macOS takes you to this screen after you log in where it kind of blurs your background and brings up this optimization screen, and it looks like it's applying or finishing up the update. And I kind of pretty quickly figured out that what I had done with that Apple disabled profile kind of screwed me up. It was sitting on that optimization screen for way too long, just sitting there spinning and spinning and spinning for like 15 minutes. And so I thought, okay, you know what? I'm just going to hard reboot the computer. Maybe it'll bypass it again. So I logged in again, went to that same screen. At this point, I was like, I thought, oh crap, I don't really know what to do here in this situation. It's been a little long since I manually backed up my computer to my hard drive, so I'll probably lose some things. And I was starting to panic a little bit. To make a long story short, what I ended up having to do was to boot macOS into safe mode, which does disable third-party system extensions, which means it turned off Little Snitch, which was able to get me to bypass that optimization screen and kind of break that loop. But as soon as it loaded into my user profile, the Wi-Fi came on. I was not protected by Little Snitch. So, you know, as soon as I noticed that, I turned the Wi-Fi off. So, you know, it was only exposed for a few seconds, but, you know, things move really, really quick in a computer system. So there was probably a good chance that Apple got some limited telemetry on me for those few seconds that the Wi-Fi was on and Little Snitch was not running. You know, the moral of the story there is when you're updating, if you're using macOS and Little Snitch, keep it on that. If you're using profiles, keep it on that profile that allows the computer to reach back out. I think what happened, and my best guesstimation here, is that when it had rebooted and installed the update, it was trying to reach the update server to probably confirm that it had had, you know, the proper integrity checks or whatever, or maybe see if there's any other pending updates out there. It was trying to talk to that server and it couldn't, because I changed the profile, and so it just got stuck in that infinite loop. So again, moral of the story being is if you're in that position, let it do its thing. Once the update has been applied, then change the update. Also back up your stuff more often. Why? I don't know why I didn't do that. Kind of a noob move, but that was my privacy loss. Wasn't as catastrophic as it could have been.
Well, I feel like we've covered some wins and losses there. Our 101 course is actually almost at a close. We have maybe one more episode left. We'll probably discuss communications, which hopefully a lot of you know the options available to us, but maybe you'll hear something you didn't know, or maybe the very least, it'll push you to try the options that are maybe recommended generally. And hopefully we'll hear some requests from you guys as to maybe other things you want to hear about.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. I'm excited to bring on some other voices to the show and explore some topics in greater detail. So one more episode, as you mentioned, and then we're kind of done with the 101s. And if you're enjoying the series so far and you have a friend or a family that you want to try to persuade to be more privacy-oriented, send them an episode and see if that maybe nudges them in the right direction. And as Jay mentioned, we're always down to hear your feedback.
Thank you for listening to Signal Jam. We'll catch you again next time. Stay private.
Stay private.